Everybody reasonably comfortable? Sort of? Okay, so we can actually begin. So, for the sutta class, people still coming in. Find a nice seat out of the sun, because now you've got a sunny face again. Oh well, as long as you're comfortable. So, this is the sutta class for the afternoon, trying to fix or censor all the teachings on meditation around the teachings of the Buddha. And so I'm going to start trying to make sure that these sutta classes aren't just for theory. It's not like a class where you get examined afterwards. To trying to make it so it connects with our practice of meditation, especially the practice of mindfulness of breathing. So, here we go, and you can always interrupt me at any time, just put your hand up and just to question some of the things that are being said. So, as you all know, I would hope, that you do have the Eightfold Path, and that Eightfold Path has number 7 as right mindfulness, and number 8 as? Very good, you remembered, whenever I ask a question, don't answer it. Because there's always some sort of trick there anyway. And the 8th one is Samma Samadhi. Often people translate that as right concentration, but concentration is way too forceful. It is not the best rendering of samadhi. And if it was the best translation of what we're doing here, then this would become a concentration camp. Which it is certainly not. It's a mindfulness, stillness, peace and happiness. And the importance of those peace and happiness will come up during these afternoon sessions. And so instead I call it right stillness. So from mindfulness to stillness. And it's basically what you're doing when you're meditating. So I'm going to start with number 7. I'm going to just go through it pretty sort of quickly, missing a lot of things which aren't really relevant. And for those of you who've read the suttas before, you find how difficult they are to read because it's a lot of repetition and there's a lot of words which make no sense. And because the translation is usually done word by word, that it becomes very hard to understand, and it certainly does not have the oomph of the power to connect people with the practice of meditation. However, that I have followed the person who taught me Pali, which was Professor A.K. Warder, who said, never translate word for word. If you translate word for word, you get into many difficulties. Such as, I already mentioned many, many times, the idiom of it's raining cats and dogs. There's many other idioms, like a young girl says, I've got a bun in the oven. Do you know that slang term? Okay, that means they're pregnant. Having a bun in the oven. So if you translate words like that, you get totally different meanings than is actually meant. So that's why the units of language is a sentence or a phrase. So if you said, you know, that somebody, your daughter had a bun in the oven, it didn't mean she was cooking. You'd say that, you know, she found out she was pregnant. She was expecting or something. So these are little ways that we change translations to make them more relevant, more modern, more understandable, and more powerful. Phrase by phrase, never word by word. So, you'll find this in this translation. What now is right mindfulness? the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only. Straight away, foundations of mindfulness, which is a usual translation. What does that mean? Four focuses of mindfulness is where you place your mindfulness, where they are directed. Well, the trouble with this thing is, okay. Good. Where they're directed. And lead in one direction only to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to the attainment of the true way, to the realization of Nibbana. And if ever you come across, and I don't mind saying this, I'm senior enough now that I can get away with it, if you come across with some scallywag monks who start talking about, you know what scallywag means? That's another word I suppose I have to translate. It means that monks who really should know better, who are translating not because of what's really there, what they should know, and what this word means, and because of their own personal, biases. When it says ekayana, sometimes people think, oh, that's the one and only way. And it never means that at all. It's like a single going, which even Bhikkhu Bodhi translated very well as lead in one direction only. It's not the only way. The only way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. And that's said so many times. So, anyway, the four focuses of mindfulness. And what are those four focuses of mindfulness? 1, 2, 3, 4. You don't see in the suttas lists 1, 2, 3, 4, or A, B, C, D, E. However, that's a wonderful way in our modern languages where we can make lists so that people can readily understand them. And so a simple innovation like that really helps. The four focuses of mindfulness, having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of experience, vedana, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the mind, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of mind objects, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. There's a bit of repetition there, but if you look at the original, that is so abridged and carries the meaning. So first of all, with those four focuses of mindfulness, you see one of the first things we have to do is to restrain the five hindrances. Those five hindrances, as any meditator knows, its first one is like wanting something. Because otherwise you see what you want to see, and you don't see what is really there. My usual simile is when young people go out for the evening, for a nice romantic night, where do they go? They go to a dark nightclub, or they go to a candlelit dinner, or a walk by the river, under the moonlight. There's many other romantic places where boys and girls fall in love. And I wondered, what do all those places have in common? The nightclub, or the bar, or the cinema, or the walk under the moonlight, or the candlelit dinner. What they all have in common is they are all dark. The light is so low that you cannot truly see with accuracy, with what they say in computer technologies, high definition resolution, what your partner really looks like. So it gives your mind a lot of freedom to add this and interpret that, to fantasize, so the person in front of you looks like some rock star, some amazing, beautiful supermodel, because you can't truly see what you're going out with. So you're wanting. is actually changes the truth to suit what you want to see. And it's the same, the next hindrances of ill will. You can't see what you don't like seeing. And so, you may be your enemy, your boss, if you don't like your boss. You see them and just, they're terrible. You can't see past that. Because these hindrances are bending the truth. Now there's this one little story which is not in the suttas here, but it just shows you the power of how what you want to see changes what you actually do see. Or more specifically, what challenges you too much actually denies that your observation any accuracy. And this was told to me a couple of years ago by, again, one of my old friends from Cambridge, a very good friend of Stephen Hawking's and me. Because this fellow, Professor Bernard Carr, that he was the very first Buddhist I met when I went to Cambridge and getting my social life together. There was all these clubs which you could join, and it was called Society's Fair, where you could, all the societies you could possibly think of, including, because it was Cambridge, fox hunting. You could, as a student, you could join the fox hunting club. But foxes couldn't join, obviously. But students could. They didn't last very long. But one of the clubs I saw there was the Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. And I couldn't believe it. There was other Buddhists in this world other than me. And, you know, I was a Buddhist when I was 16, but, you know, what do you do next? And so, sort of, I was so excited. I remember going to the counter. There was this young student there who was manning the counter that time when I was there. And I gave him a pound note and I said, I want to join. He said, you don't have to. Just come and see. You don't have to be a Buddhist. I said, look, I am a Buddhist. I want to join. He said, no. I don't know why it's only Buddhists. Maybe many other religions, they take your money straight away. But it's quite impressive, really, but I really wanted to join. And I got angry at him. I banged it down, join me, now. So he signed me up, and that was Bernard Carr. And so the first Buddhist I ever met, not the first Buddhist monk, the first Buddhist. And of course, he was Buddhist at that time, and he was also theoretical physics. He was also the other thing we liked in the Astronomical Society, and also into the Psychic Research Society, where we literally went hunting ghosts together. Now, this is England, and of course, you know, English had lots and lots of ghosts. But, you know, they're very hard to find. Honestly, some people are scared of them, but they're really shy. Especially when you're not scared of them, because maybe we ghost hunters, we're no fun. Yeah. But anyway, what was that story of... No, I could have stopped, otherwise I'd go on all afternoon, I suppose. But now I've started, I've got to carry on. About this woman from Australia who went to England on holiday. And of course, when you go to a place like England on holiday from Australia, of course you'll go touring the castles, because they don't have castles in Australia. And so she went to one of these really old castles and had to go with a guide who took her right down to places where the dungeons were, where they did terrible things to people. And they are really spooky places. If you've ever been to the underground dungeons, we can go on tours. No, well, maybe there are things in there, because it was really creepy. Every time they opened these old wooden doors. Every time they passed the window. And by the end of the tour, she was really scared. But, you know, she was out in the open air, so she felt a degree of safety. But she couldn't help turning around to the guide and say, have you ever seen any ghosts in this castle? And the guide said, in all the years I've lived in this castle, I've never ever seen a ghost. And the woman had to ask the question, how many years have you lived in this castle? He said, over 300. But anyway, back off the tangent to actually Bernard Carr. He became like a Buddhist and a good friend. And I never realized how close he was to Stephen Hawking's, but he was one of his, you know, really just right-hand students. Stephen, you know, went to Bernard's marriage, and even there was a movie made about Professor Hawking's, The Theory of Everything. And actually, I watched that movie because that Bernard was in it. He was featured in it as one of the Stephen Hawking's associates. So he was really close to Professor Hawking's. But he also, like every good scientist, would always explore some of the most interesting parts of our world, you know, to find out new ideas of what reality is. And the experiment he described to me was performed in the Imperial College in London, which is a very prestigious college of science and engineering. And the experiment was the levitating flower pot, with really quite well-known scientist declared he found a secret of levitation. How he could take an object and raise it in the air. So, this scientist, one of Bernard's friends, he invited all these top scientists in London, professors, Nobel laureates, people who really had a huge reputation as hard-nosed scientists, to come and watch this demonstration, because this friend of Bernard's had cred in the science world. You know, cred, no credibility. So they all came, and the Bernard's friend came in with a flower pot. He carried it in his hand and put it on the bench. You know these old lecture halls in science faculties? They had this big wooden bench and the seats where the students usually sat, not the professors, going up. And they had top of the range cameras, infrared, ultraviolet, high definition, because if it did work, they wanted to record the evidence that levitation had been demonstrated amongst some of the top scientists of London. And so, he put the flower pot on the table, no wires, no anything to lift it, and then he said, in order to create the right atmosphere, I need your help. I want everybody, you know, all my colleagues in the scientific world to start chanting Om. Om, which is a mystic Hindu word, Om. And so, all these old, bearded, crusty old scientists started chanting Om, Om, Om. And that was when the flower pot lifted up into the air. It actually worked. They demonstrated in front of one of the most distinguished gathering of experimental scientists in London, levitation of a flower pot. They filmed it, they photographed it. pretty heavy, strong current had just been turned on. That's all. But that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was that flower pot lifted and a couple of really strong, objective scientists blocked it out. They didn't even know they were blocking out the evidence. The flower pot, in their conscious awareness, these were trained observers. That flower pot remained on the table throughout. In other words, levitation was so impossible for them, that it was blocked from their conscious awareness. They didn't even see it. It's not as if they saw it and rubbed their eyes. It never came up past the filters of consciousness into their awareness. They never perceived it. That was the point of the experiment. Can we really trust our perceptions? If it's too sort of a conflict, we won't see it. And they proved that. So this is why the second hindrance is denial. We just don't see it. And the third hindrance is the old sloth and torpor. Too tired to see anything. I don't know if when you first get up in the morning, sometimes you wake up and you think, oh, it's just really, really, really dark. And you realize you're still under the blanket. You're not really fully aware of what you're doing until you've had your first cup of coffee, some people. So anyway, that when you're dull, your awareness, you don't know what you're doing. And also the opposite of that, restlessness. So restlessness, you don't stay with anything long enough to know what's happening. To actually really know something, you've got to stay with it. Stay with it long enough for it to teach you its secrets. And lastly, the doubt, which also stops you seeing clearly. So those are the five hindrances. So you restrain the five hindrances, which is most of the job of the previous factors of the Eightfold Path. And then, once you've restrained the five hindrances, if any of you see the traditional translation here, which sometimes I don't know how anyone claiming to be a Pali scholar can get away with this. They say, Loke Apicca Domanasa, having restrained grief and covetousness for the world. And what the heck does that mean? And so what occurred with monks like me, we just, okay, let's read it in the original, the Pali. You see those words occur again and 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 again. Loke Apicca Domanasa, and it means having restrained the five hindrances. It's there in the whole text. They say it again and again. Even the commentaries say that. It means having restrained the five hindrances. And that actually gives you meaning. What you have to do before you do the four focuses of mindfulness. How can you be mindful when these five hindrances are bending the truth to suit what you want to see? Now, this is really important in all aspects of life. You know, sometimes people get sick. They may have a little hard bump on their breast. Oh no, this is just a little bite, insect bite, when it's a blooming tumour coming up. Because that frightens you, breast cancer, you won't see it. You won't notice it until, it's much later than it should be. You can't see it because it's too challenging for you. Which is one of the problems there. If you can catch it early, you can do something about it. It's been there for days. But because of the negativity, that is one of the reasons why. You don't catch it early enough. You don't actually see it. Because your bias challenges you. And it's the same that, sometimes couples, they think, oh, everything's going well. Oh, I have a wonderful relationship with my partner. And then the next day, the partner's gone. And they say, well, I've been telling you for years, darling. But you don't see it, because it's too challenging for you to see, what is this really hard for a person to take. So these five hindrances are really powerful, brilliant teaching of psychology of the Buddha of how we don't face the truth. We prefer to see what we want to see. Like we have the biggest crowd of any president's inauguration. We don't see what's really there. Let's be honest. Instead of bending the truth to fit what you want to see. So anyway, we five hindrances. You abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. Knowing the purpose, why are you being aware of the body? We'll find out in a moment. And anyway, I'm going to skip now, number 2, 3, 4, and go mindfulness of the body. How are you aware of the body? And you start off with mindfulness of breathing, the old mindfulness of breathing, basic meditation. So, how are you aware of the body? Or mindfulness of breathing is one way. You go to a quiet, secluded place. Sit down comfortably and give priority to establishing mindfulness. Those three precursors to watching the breath. And I say that because it's important. When you can meditate, you're a very skilled meditator, you can meditate anywhere. You know that sometimes I challenge myself. As going to Thailand once to another conference, and the host who met me at Suvarnabhumi Airport said, "Oh, we're just waiting for another guest presenter. Would you mind just do you want a cup of tea or coffee or something while we wait? Can we wait? It's an hour, and then they come back. They'll be arriving." I said, "Yeah, okay. I don't need a cup of tea and coffee. I just sit down and meditate." In the middle of the concourse, which was really busy, with people going all over the place. And so you just sit down, cross your legs, and I learned how to make my own cave. What do I mean? Create a nice little bubble around you. And so you hear the noise on the outside, but not, you've got the perception of being inside something, your own little area. And then you can just sit down and meditate and just have wonderful meditations, even though it's really noisy outside. So you can stay really peaceful and calm by using little visualizations. But it's much better to go to a place like this. This can be, when I stop talking, can be such a quiet place. And of many places I've been in the world, the forests of Australia, especially at night time, it's just so silent. We did choose, in particular, there's no flight path over this monastery. No jets, maybe every now and again you get a private plane going over, but no sort of big commercial airlines go over this place. And it's a long way from the road. You've got the road up the top there, but it's not exactly a high density traffic road. And so there's the nearest village, Serpentine, is not sort of like a red light district with lots of bars and noise and concerts. It's a very quiet part of the world. That's why we chose this place. It's silent. So you can actually feel that quietness. And so when you go to a quiet, secluded place, you know, you're almost halfway there. And then you sit down comfortably. And I stress that word, comfortably. Because if you're not comfortable, it may be quiet outside, but you've got the sound of aches and pains which disturb your tranquility. So this is not about learning how to sit for hours on broken glass with a straight back. What was it when I used to go to Wong Fat Choi Temple? Could I get that right, Wong Fat Choi? Wong Fat Choi. Oh, Wong Fat Choi. Oh, it's 50%. That's not bad. Not bad for a Kuai Lo. Good enough. But when I went there, one of the advantages in those days, I wasn't so well known, so that you used to stay in these temples and you'd meet all these other monks. You know, it's like a crossroads. And of course, you gossip. Interesting gossip. What was it like in your temple? What was going on? This one monk came from mainland China, and he was just saying about what happened in one of the monasteries there, where they were doing a Zen retreat. And on the Zen retreat, I've been to those when I was a lay person, and you're sitting down there with your facing the wall, and just behind you comes the master with the Zen stick. Have you ever seen those? Wow, it's pretty scary. But anyway, he said he wasn't there, but it was a monastery which he knew of, and the master came around with the Zen stick, and anyone who was not paying attention, who was nodding, got whacked on the back with a Zen stick. And he said, a true story, that this middle-aged woman got whacked on the back with a Zen stick, and she was not happy. So she got out her cell phone and called the police. And the police came to the temple, to the meditation hall, and arrested that monk and took him away. And that was the end of the retreat. It's a real true story. You can't do that these days. Anyway, so that's not how you sit down comfortably with fear. In other words, you find a comfortable position. And those chairs which you are sitting in the back there, I spent a lot of time going to different places with friends, especially, I don't know if you remember Chi Wei and Peng. Yeah, we went to so many places looking for a nice meditation chairs. They had to be roughly the right height, not too hard, not too soft. And these are the ones we came up with. And they were, for those people in Malaysia produced those. And they were sort of, we tried them out, sat in them, just because we wanted a chair which was good for meditation. So that's actually how much effort myself and the others put in to try and get nice chairs for you. And because of that, it means that you can sit comfortably. You don't have to sit on the floor to get deep meditation or to get enlightened. So, and even those chairs, that some of them, that sometimes people's posture, they start leaning one way or the other way. If you start leaning one way or another way, then you sit in the chairs with the armrest, so you can't sort of go too far over. If you are someone who always tends to lean forward and rocks, then we can get seatbelt out for you. So that you won't fall off. So, in other words, we try and keep it comfortable. Because that's sit down comfortably. And if you are sitting down on the floor, you can actually just get nice cushions. There's a heap of cushions available. You've got these wooden benches, the Zen stools. And it's important that you find the best comfort for your body. That's important to meditate. It's simple kindness and relaxation. So, you quiet place, sit down comfortably, you look after your bodily needs, and give priority to establishing mindfulness. What does that mean? Sometimes they say, and I was just talking with this woman, Shayla Catherine, over in Berkeley a few days ago. We were just discussing establishing mindfulness, putting mindfulness in front of you. That's the usual translation. And what the heck does that mean? Instead, the right translation is giving priority, putting it number one, put it in the front. That's what that means. It's those idioms again. So make mindfulness, establishing mindfulness, the first thing you do once you've got your body comfortable. How do you establish mindfulness? What you do is where is mindfulness? Mindfulness in the present moment. Basically, present moment awareness and silence. So you're actually aware of what's happening rather than thinking about it. In this moment, not what happened a moment ago, not what you expect to happen now. You're not really mindful of this, what's happening now. Here's the reality right now. And you learn how to be aware right now without giving it a name. That's a wonderful thing. Maybe it's the time to do this. I'm not sure if I did this little exercise before. when you hold something up, what is this I'm holding up? This is not a trick, okay? I want some answers. Did I do this the first night?
No.
Okay, but other retreats, I often do this. Now, one of the places I did this little exercise was in Daejeon in Korea, because I was invited in to give the keynote address at the 2015 World Computer Congress. And it was such a weird invitation, I made time for it. It was an invitation to go, please excuse me, to Hong Kong to give a talk. Now I'm too busy. But I've never been to give a keynote address to a World Computer Congress, because I don't know too much about computers, as all the monks in monastery will tell you. And so this was really a cool invitation. So I went there, and first of all, they said, what are you doing here? I'm a monk. And they had a really sort of, you know, hotshot computer, anyone from Samsung and from LG, and also from over in Google and Facebook, and you know, these European, they were really talking about cyber security in those days. So I had the head of the European Union Cyber Security Task Force, really sort of, you know, high-flying group of people there, plus a monk who left the world. So, but I told them that this is all about not just hearing what you already know, but hearing things a slightly bit different to enhance your knowledge and understanding so you can take things further. And obviously, whatever I said, they really enjoyed, because, you know, they gave me really a 5-star hotel room and business class. And they gave $2,000 donation to monastery just for 15 minutes work. Really good. So anyway, I said to them, I picked up a glass bottle and I said, now what is this? So what is this? What do you see here? Now you can participate now. What am I holding up? What else? You say, come on, give me more description. What else? Come and give me some more details. Describe it to me. Keep on going. Now sometimes people think, oh, there's the right answer. And the way they say, yes, well done, you get the prize. And there's no prize. There's no final answer. But what you find, the longer you look, the more you see. And so often in our modern world, we look at something, we give it a name, cup, and we go on to the next job. And we miss so much of what's actually here. And if you keep on looking for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, you start seeing things which you never expected to see, which you can't really give a name to, because language only just sees just the outside of stuff. This is actually where we understand exploration, the basis of insight, seeing things you haven't seen before. Your partner, do you really know them? Person you've lived with for 30, 40 years, you sure you'd really know who they are? You don't even know who you are. But you think, oh, that's just my wife. No, he's always like that. You don't know him at all. You don't know what a cuff is. So after a while, you go so deep into these things, you're not thinking, you're not giving things names. All those thoughts have gone a long time ago. You're exhausted, the names and descriptions, you're just observing in silence. And what you see just is amazing. When you go outside and see the sunset, don't write an essay about it, or write a poem. At least poets have this amazing ability in just a few words to actually to get an emotion, to elicit, to incite an emotion which fits the scene. But I can't do that. Thoughts just fail. when you're just watching or just feeling the wind in your face. You never know from where the wind's coming. You never know where it goes to. You only know it as it passes your face right now. And you can't really give it a name. If you try and describe the feeling of the wind as it passes your face, you're missing the next experience, which comes right behind. So mindfulness and silence is where you become truly aware of existing, of experience. You feel, you know, without giving things a name. I don't know this evening if it's going to be a nice, clear night. If it is, please go out to those stupas, you know, the little monuments outside, sit on it, and even lay on your back, if it's not too wet and damp, and just look at the stars. This is the southern hemisphere. You see the Milky Way, and it's so clear. Sometimes some of those books in some of those picture books we have, people have taken photographs, and that's one of the most wonderful sights. They're laying on your back and seeing the stars in the heavens above, clear. You try thinking about your business. You won't be able to. The stars are just far more powerful. You're mindful. You're silent. You're just aware. And it's impossible to give these things names. And don't even try. So, you get some idea what mindfulness is. Establishing mindfulness. It's one of the reasons why it's, you know, what is it, Sunday today, and Ajahn Brahm, people have asked me, Ajahn Brahm, when are you going to teach us how to meditate? You know what people want? They want, okay, breathing in, breathing out, that's stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, just like at school. You know, like mass one, mass two, mass three. You know, just to get the mindfulness going, first of all, to get aware, be alive. When you have your food, don't just eat. One spoon, using chopsticks or spoons here, or forks, or... What are you eating? Spoon, okay. When you have a spoon, get a spoonful of food when next time you eat. It's a long time to you next. I shouldn't mention eating. Make you feel hungry. Next time you eat something, take the spoon and put it in the mouth slowly and really savour the food. And don't, what many people do, they've got a morsel of food in their mouth, they're sort of chewing it, they've got another one on the spoon, waiting in line, and three or four sort of piles of food, that's number three, that's number four, and they're thinking, they're way ahead of themselves. So instead, just one spoon at a time, and really enjoy the taste. And if you really enjoy, you don't think of the spoonful coming next. You don't think of what's going to happen in another 10 minutes. Just one spoon at a time, and you enjoy it. Then you find all the saliva, the bile, everything else which is supposed to come out of your system all comes out because you're enjoying that food, being aware of it. And that means you get very healthy. You digest your food well. Because when you are aware of it and its delicious tastes, you find everything which is needed to digest that food comes out. Just prove it to you now. Think of your favorite food. You can even close your eyes. You can actually visualize it. You can see the steam coming out, and you can almost smell it and imagine it, visualize it, that food. Can you feel the saliva coming out of your mouth? You better stop now, because that food is not going to come. But nevertheless, you can see just how being mindful and aware actually creates good digestion. So when you establish mind, you're in the moment, you're here, and you're reasonably quiet, that is what I've tried to encourage the last 2 days. That is important meditation. Relaxing. being here. Stop trying to get into jhanas yet. Just be here. And then once you've established mindfulness, then mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. It says on here, actually, we are doing suttas. It's not the sutta according to Ajahn Brahm. It's supposed to be the sutta of the Buddha, with only a few comments by me. So mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. Keep it simple. When in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware they are short. When in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. And I often ask, and I remember just giving this consideration to the people over in Berkeley. I said, what happens if your breath isn't long or short? What if it's in the middle? What if it's two-thirds? It's sort of half long, but, you know, a bit on the short side. Are you following the Buddha's instructions, or should you really? Okay, make it really short so you can fulfill the Buddha's instructions. And just a really short breath, okay? And then a really long one to make sure you're doing it right. Now you can see just how people, they take some of these instructions and just they follow them as stupid as anything. All it really means is that you know your breath is longish or shortish, or it just gives you something to observe to make the breath a little bit more interesting, and you don't have to notice it's long or short. You can just visualize breathing in peace, breathing out, let go. This is where that fits in to the Buddha's teachings on meditation. Just make it slightly interesting, just until you can really watch the breath without needing these any extras. So then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. The whole of the breath. From the beginning to the end of the breath. The space between the breaths. And the beginning of the out-breath until the out-breath finishes. You see the whole lot. Why? Because you are mindful. If you start thinking, what usually happens, oh, this is stupid, when is this going to end? What am I going to do next? You know, I should be really sort of checking the emails. I wonder what's happening in the election. I wonder what happened in the sport. What's the stock market? They're going to be releasing. And straight away, the train of thoughts. That's why they call it in English, the train of thoughts. Because once it's left the station, it's almost impossible to put the brakes on. But if you can catch the train when it hasn't really got any momentum up yet, you can put the brakes on and it stops straight away. So, you just watch the whole of the breath quietly. And after a while, you surprise yourself. It's not that hard to do. Never think you can't do this. It's just you haven't done it yet. Some of the most amazing people I thought would never ever be able to meditate and be peaceful. They can do it. Those are the ones I like. People say, I've got too much of a restless mind, not me. I'm not good enough. I can't sit still for a few minutes. My job is like a coach. Yes, you can. Why not? I've had some crazy people here meditating. One of the craziest people I had here meditating was this fellow who he came here on the registration. I just happened to be just, you know, by the office there. Because when he came in, he was this big guy, Australian guy, and, you know, scars on him and tattoos all over him. You know, and he didn't look like your normal meditator at all. He looked like he belonged up the prison. It was up the road. And so making huge mistake, you know, I judged him. And I said, excuse me, sir, this is the monastery. The prison is 6 kilometres up there. And I said that. And he looked at me and said, no, I'm on this retreat, this is my name. And his name was there, he'd booked in, I never met him before. But this really rough guy was, you know, on my retreat. Okay. And I thought, you know, it's not going to last very long. And then when he came into one of the interviews, he said, I had this experience, and I was really amazed. This guy got into a jhana, one of the deepest meditations, and I don't tell people to go into jhanas easily. I'm one of the toughest examiners when you say you've got into deep meditation. I say, no, not you. But this guy did. And that really is the last person I would have expected. If he can do that. So if you can't do it yet, then get some tattoos and come back. But it's amazing. Anyone can do this with the right teaching and pressing the right buttons. So you follow the instructions, seclude your place, come to a nice place. It doesn't have to be here in this room. Your bedrooms. Now, sometimes here you got peer pressure, and you think, oh, what am I doing? Peer pressure can be helpful. You know, you get a bit of energy coming up, you know, because other people are around you. But sometimes, you know, if you're a bit sort of sick or, you know, you need to go to the toilet, in your rooms, in your cottages, you close the door there, you get the temperature just nice, and you can meditate there. And some of the people have some of the best meditations in their cottages. Or, now this is not the right time of year, but sometimes people go, again, on the stupas, they take a cushion up there, or they go into the forest. There's so many lovely places where you can meditate. The one place I'd say not to meditate is in the kitchen. I'm just waiting for lunch. Get in people's way, but so many lovely places you can meditate here, so please make use of the facilities. And that means that you find that comfort and you just sit down, establish mindfulness. I think the first night you go into the body, just relaxing, make sure you're really relaxed. That's a great way of establishing the mindfulness. You're sitting down, making sure your toes, your knees, everything is just nice. And that by itself is absolutely brilliant. That's where this girl came to say hello on Friday, Jippy. And sometimes you do these things and it works out way, way better than you ever expected. Because she was a girl who was in Adelaide, in the University of South Australia. And she had severe panic attacks. And she was bedridden. And, you know, being a student in Australia, you know, you get free healthcare. And university, they got some professors of psychology, psychiatry. They really looked after her, but nothing worked. So she was in her bed. She didn't even get out to get to the door. Fortunately, she had a boyfriend. And I tell young women, if you ever find a boyfriend like this, you know, you get a ring on him as soon as possible or whatever, because this was a boyfriend made in heaven. He would do everything for her. You know, wash her clothes and just cook for her, because she couldn't do anything. She was really sick. And so her uncle was a strong supporter over here. And so uncle said, I'm going to give Ajahn Brahm a ring. So she gave me a ring from her bed and said, what's wrong? So I got panic attacks, so severe anxiety. And that's when I said, okay, how do they feel? What does it feel like when you have anxiety attacks? What's it like? Well, it's anxious. So that is not good enough. I want a description of the feelings. I said, well, actually, first of all, so when you have anxiety attacks, where do you feel it? In your body? There was in my chest somewhere. Where exactly in your chest? Because one thing which, you know, you get to know when you're mindful and you practice meditation, every emotional instability, every emotional state manifests on your body somewhere. And so I asked her, when you have a panic attack, where do you feel it in your body? She said, in my chest. She said, not good enough. I want coordinates. Because she was a dentist, a science. So I want to know, from your navel, centimetres, even millimetres up, is it centred right in your chest or a bit further up? Is it just in one spot or is it actually spread over an area? What type of area? Is it circular? Is it ovular? You know, exactly how wide is it? And how narrow is it? And you know, does it stay like that or does it change and does it disappear? I want a description of when you have an anxiety attack, how it feels on your body. And actually where it's manifested. So because she had nothing else to do, she did that, and 3 days later she gave me a course, she gave this wonderful description of actually just how the experience spreads. You know, when she has a panic attack. And then, second question, exactly how does it feel? Is it burning? Is it tight? Is it itchy? What does it feel like? Is it always, every part of that area is the same? Give me a call in another 3 days. Well, I am very busy, and it wasn't just to try and get rid of her for 3 days to do something else. I wanted her to take some responsibility for her treatment, which is important. So 3 days later, she gave me this wonderful description of what it feels like to have a panic attack. Where it's situated in the body, the feelings associated with it, how it develops, where it spreads. I said, well done. You are now completed the first test of mindfulness. You're aware of it, how it manifests in your body. Number two, take your hand and massage the area of the body. Massage it, so with a lot of kindness. And then see what happens. And I did tell her, if you feel too weak to massage that part of your body, ask your boyfriend to do that. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. And so give me a call in 3 days. So she gave me this call in 3 days. And so what happened? Did you do that? She said, yeah, I followed the instructions. And what happened to the feeling in your chest? He said, oh, my chest relaxed, the tightness and the burning just disappeared slowly until it was all gone. And then was the light bulb moment question. And what happened to your anxiety? The cause of that tightness, tension, burning in your chest. What happened to that emotion? And it's one of these moments you never forget. She was silent for about a minute. She'd got it. Said, that went too. Great. So now you know how to deal with your anxiety problem. And again, I only tell the stories which have wonderful endings, but this has a beautiful ending. So she was out of bed in a week or two, back to studies again. She was went over to, she finished her degree, first class honours. And of course, she took my advice and she married Lloyd, with me doing all the charting for her. And I really wanted to do that, and I really missed out because, you know, that I'd given life to her. And she had a third child she brought to come and see me with Lloyd on Friday. And just, I'm her monk, just saved her life. And you see these three little kids, and just Lloyd and her, brought her out from anxiety disorder, living a wonderful life. So, this is what happens when you learn about meditation. You can experience your body, and once you experience it, it's amazing stuff you can do. You can find out if you've got a sickness. If you've got cancers, where exactly in the body do you feel the cancer? What does it feel like? Once you can feel it, say, it is, say, breast cancer or something. You feel it, you know it. You're not afraid of it. your mindfulness is so strong, you're with it. Exactly, how does it feel? How wide is it? You know, is if it's a tumour, can you actually sense that something's there? And once you get a feeling for it, then what do you have to do? So that feeling just starts to get released and it gets eased off. What? People do this. And what was the last case? It wasn't actually a cancer. This was a young girl, Sri Lankan girl, here in Perth. About 13 years of age, maybe. Or maybe a bit less than that. I can't tell these days, but maybe it could even be 10 or 11. But anyway, there's, you know, one of these people are just so full of life and energy, just enjoying just that stage of her life, popular and smart at school. But her mother bought her because she had a big problem. The doctors had found that she had a congenital defect in her spine. It was actually, the spine was twisted, but no one would even know. I wouldn't see it, but the doctors did. And they said the only the thing she had to do was to wear this metal brace for the next 3 or 4 years. Basically 24/7. And, you know, it was uncomfortable. She tried it on a few times. It really hurt. You know, but the worst part of it was having to go to school wearing this. And you know from your experience that when you go to school, anything which is different in you, the other sort of children will pick up. I was a school teacher for 1 year, and I know I suffered from hay fever, and I should have taken the day off school, but instead I went to my class, and, you know, I was trying to teach them physics or something, and, you know, instead of blowing my nose, you know, just... And it was only 5 minutes, and I looked up at my class, and about 30 children, about 13 years of age, were looking at me going... I felt terrible already, the nasty students. But you can understand and relate to that. So anyone is slightly different, or something really... And the kids pick up on that, so I felt so sorry for that girl that having to wear this... brace, and she'd get, you know, metal woman or iron lady or something for the rest of her life. And you know, at that time, you know, just starting puberty, you know, that would just destroy your confidence. And, you know, you'd be, you know, behind the eight ball with your friendships for a long time. So I knew what was happening there. My mother knew that. That's why I said, Ajahn Brahm, can you teach us a meditation? Something. And that's when I just thought of this meditation which I teach you. And, but, you know, taking it a little bit further to, later on we talk about these lights in the mind limiters. And this was an amazing little meditator. Should have really known, because her positive attitude, just bright, she never sort of thought it can't be done. Never thought, oh, not me. Just positive, just willing to do anything in this world. That purity of mind, which you sometimes you see in young children, was so powerful for the meditation success. And that's when a few weeks later, mother brought her to see me, up in Bodhinyana, the dining hall. Big smile on her face. She said, Ajahn Brahm, look what happened. What happened? And I asked her first of all, what happened? And she said, well, I was meditating, got very peaceful, and I saw this beautiful blue light in my mind, a nice nimitta. And then what did he do? Well, I imagined my spine inside this blue light. And that she'd seen her spine many times because, you know, the doctors, the specialists, you know, showed her the pictures, you know, from the machine. And she, mother even had it on her iPhone and showed me it, you know, the bent, distorted spine, which would cause her a lot of trouble. And she said, I imagined my spine in this nimitta. And I imagined straightening it. Because in these nimittas, it's amazing what you can do. Just imagine just twisting it so it was straight again. And then, that's why the mum took me to see me, she said, when she went to the next appointment with the physiotherapist to fit this cage around her upper body. Of course, they always do tests to see how things progress. And they had to do another test, because there must be something wrong with the machine. The bottom half had straightened. What the heck are you be doing? And she showed me, she still had the rest of the half to actually to straighten up, but they showed me the two sort of photos from the machine. And you could see just how the lower half was now straight. Well, the upper half, one of them, well, she did have a bit more to do, but you can see most of it was all straightened up. And of course, wow, this stuff actually works. So when you start doing this meditation stuff, we don't rush it though. Get comfortable, peaceful state. Get mindfulness going. And with the mindfulness, a bit of happiness as well. That's an important part of mindfulness. If you're enjoying this, and if I inspire you, don't go on for too long. You know, it's in a comfortable body. Then it's so easy to do. Then you can just watch this breath go in and out. Later on, you get these wonderful experiences in your body. And it's amazing what you can do. So anyway, that's the first paragraph. But I think it's useful. So you just know the in-breath. And you experience the whole of the breath. It just, please don't look upon this as stage one, stage two. And you say, oh, I'm at stage two now. Let it happen so naturally. It occurs by itself. You're watching the breath go in and out. And after a while, you're just watching the whole of the breath, beginning to the end. And then the breath gets very calm as you breathe in and out. Just as a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when the in-breath is long, you are just aware it's long or short. The reason I said that is because if you look at the original simile in the suttas, it says just as a skilled lathe operator knows they're making a long turn or a short turn. And that is regarding a lathe which I remember I used in northeast of Thailand, because it was a simple thing which you basically constructed yourself and you can understand what the heck they're talking about. But because these lathes have today electric, you don't make short turns, long turns. The simile doesn't make sense because it's anachronistic. It's, you know, of a time long gone. And so it's important that when we do translations, we translate the meaning, not the details, so that you don't confuse people. Later on, you might see the simile. It's a technical simile. The difference between a non-returner and a fully enlightened one. It's said, just like a washerwoman, they go and wash a white cloth with cow poo. Cow dung, because that's what they used to use to wash clothes with in those days. And straight away the simile, you think, what? Is that a good translation? Or is that what they actually did in those days? And, you know, isn't that sort of unhygienic? But apparently it was very hygienic. You know, even these days you can see in India people cooking their food with cow dung, and they put it on the walls of their houses, the cow dung. And so it's not much of a stretch of the imagination that some time ago, when they didn't have detergent, they would use cow dung to wash their clothes. Maybe that's one of the reasons why monks' robes are brown. But what that does, that takes away from the simile. You're thinking about dung instead of, you know, so I change the simile. Just as if you wash your clothes in a washing machine, you know, with detergent, and then you spin it, you rinse it, and then you put it in a dryer, and then even afterwards it still has the smell of the detergent. And then you put it on the line to dry in the sun, and then after a while the smell of the detergent is gone. So this is just obvious little changes in the similes to make it more relevant, easily understandable, so you don't get sidetracked thinking about, instead of what the simile is trying to point out, oh, I wonder what they did with cow dung in those days. And just the, so anyway, that's why I changed some of these translations. So anyway, that is, I think, enough for now. The suttas, yes, are important, but the main reason I wanted to talk about this today is to give a little bit more instructions on meditation. What you're actually supposed to do or not do. So you don't, please don't think that I'm abandoning you and just, oh, maybe other people know how to meditate but not me. Please give me some instructions. This is how we meditate. Calm, sitting down in a calm place. Doesn't have to be in here. Doesn't have to be on a chair. Doesn't have to be for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 2 hours or whatever. Keep it natural. Forget about time. If you ever want to actually to find out what time it is, go in that meditation, walking meditation room, and you can tell the time on the 2 clocks over there. You're sitting next there, can you please, what time is it on the clocks?
10 to 3.
But what you can do is actually just, if you're hungry, please move the things back to 11 a.m. I can eat now. So, in other words, don't worry about time. So you meditate, relax, and you're actually encouraging, establishing mindfulness, awareness. You're coming here instead of looking for truth somewhere else, in the future, in the past, wherever. And you come here and eventually you start relaxing, the body is happy, and you start watching the breath, breathing in, breathing out, and it becomes such an easy thing to do if you do the preparations. So I don't mind spending days doing preparations. If you feel you're not getting anywhere, great, because you're not supposed to get anywhere, you're supposed to be here. People sometimes, this one person caught me out. I was carrying some stuff, some papers in our Nolamala Center, which you're going to visit on Friday night. And he said, how are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? I said, I'm getting there. Where exactly are you getting, Ajahn Brahm? Okay, caught me out. You know what, I know where I'm going. I'm going to either a grave, a cremation, or I'm going to the cemetery. He said, I'm getting there. Where are you getting? Where are you rushing towards? You're rushing towards your death. That's the only place you're going. So if ever you ask me, and I say, I know where you're going, Della. So where am I going? Going to the cemetery. Of course. You can't, that's going to happen. So anyway, so it's not going anywhere, it's being here. Stopping. Being here. Finding out what it's like to be alive. First of all, it's not that pleasant, it's a bit scary. You're not running away from this moment. You're actually being here. You get used to it, being here. And after a while, it's a beautiful place to hang out. This is where all the wisdom lies. Your future is being made right now. This is the only time you have to make your body healthy, your mind free, and alive, and prepared to face the world when you leave here. Here is where your future is made. You understand that, you spend more time in this moment. And you're not sort of, neglecting your responsibilities and duties. You're actually making them easier to fulfill. So that's one of the reasons why, that when you start meditating, you watch the breath go in and go out, and you invigorate your mind, energize it. Even the chainsaw needs to be sharpened. So, you're not cutting down any trees when you're sharpening your chainsaw, in that simile from earlier on. That's how we meditate. And of course, more instructions coming tomorrow. But anything I missed out, there is the question box, and you can ask the questions there, and we'll see how many questions I can actually answer tonight. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So I wish you a happy afternoon. Feedback, if you thought this was useful, great. If you think, nah, because I was just thinking, should we do guided meditation or sutta class? So sometimes guided meditation can be really useful. So give me some feedback, whether more sutta class or guided meditation. Because when I do guided meditation, I take you along with me and you get an experience instead of more words. But anyway, let me know what you think. Okay, have a nice afternoon.